The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
All-time highs across the board. Hurricane Irma wrecks Florida. Bitcoin crashes, and our guest today is Raul Paul of Real Vision. All this and much more on episode number 526 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. A very windy and stormy hello to you. This is Andrew Horowitz, the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And yes, we are working and online. We got the power back in the office last Friday. Still don't have any power at the house, so we've been sleeping at some friends' houses and hotels and trying to make the most and the best of a very difficult situation. It's over 90-something degrees here in South Florida, and for the last several days after we had that massive hurricane blow through, there was like no wind, no breeze. The heat was just sitting upon us, and I did sleep in the house a couple of nights. But I got to tell you something, it was miserable, absolutely miserable. Even with, a buddy of mine had a generator, we put it on, we had some fans going, and it was horrible. But again, we are safe, so that's good. A little bit of cleanup here, and the Tiki Hut held up pretty well. A little bit of damage there, the boat was fine, the house was fine. So all of that is good. That's good. The good news. There's a lot of damage around, and a lot of people that are suffering. And we are pretty lucky here that it did swerve off to the west a little bit at the last minute. And we got, again, plenty of wind, plenty of rain, plenty of flooding, but nothing like they saw in Houston, of course, that is still digging out from the hurricane that they saw the week before. And now we're seeing there's another one building. There's another storm building in the Atlantic that's moving over. Jose is moving up to North Carolina and then possibly up to New York. And there's another tropical storm and depression that's building. Oh man, I hope it doesn't come, because now all the trees are very loosely rooted and very weak, and it can cause a lot of damage. I'll tell you something. So not the best of hurricane seasons in the area of Florida and the East Coast of the United States. I'll tell you that much right now. But again, we are doing well here. Thank you for all the well wishes and support and comments and concern that you'd sent via either Twitter or directly through email. I really appreciate all of your concern and your thoughts and prayers. Let's talk about what's going on in the markets. Of course, with all of the hurricane issues that have been going on, we've been seeing that many stocks that are related to the hurricane, like Generac, which is a company that has generators, is doing pretty well. Airlines not doing so well. Many of the restaurants and businesses that rely on tourism in South Florida not doing so well. But we are seeing that there has been a continuation of the general uptrend, all-time highs on the NASDAQ, the Dow, and the S&P 500. Global markets are also following foot and doing really well, even in the face of some concerning issues with economics, which we'll get to in a second. We'll talk about what's going on last week, what the report showed us, and what's happening up until through next week as well. But one of the things that has been continuing to provide some support is, of course, not only the desire to get in on this really hot market in the U.S. and around the world in equities, but also the fact that there is very low interest rates. There is liquidity in the trillions that were pushed into markets throughout the year. And of course, we have now the carrot dangling in front of us that there will be the hope for some kind of tax reform. They started the engines running as soon as Congress got back into session. And we're seeing from the White House and through Congress a discussion of anywhere from a 15 to a 20% corporate tax rate. And that has been really, doing a lot to help out the potential for markets. Not the only reason, but one of the reasons, and I think it's been positioned in a way that it's going to pass in 2017. And depending on how it actually plays out, if it does in fact pass, the big question about whether it's going to be retroactive or if it's going to be starting sometime in 2018. But again, a lot of that is just speculation because we still haven't seen any details. There's been nothing. So right now we are seeing that at least there is a concerted effort to get something going, but no details, and details are very sketchy. That seems to be the play these days, whether it's from healthcare or any bills that were passed or any kind of legislative actions that are being proposed. Very little in the way of detail. And in a way, it seems to be really good for markets because there's nothing to worry about. The hope is that we're going to get the best, the most incredible tax reform, the lowest rate possible. And without details, there's nothing to counter that. So I think that there's a lot of hope riding on that. And I think that may be something that the parties that be are using as a way to continue to keep enthusiasm high and confidence up. And that's working, even in the face of some of these natural disasters that are concerning. As a matter of fact, I saw some reports out that and some Fed officials talk about how hurricanes and the massive destruction will actually lead to a very significant growth in GDP over the next, let's say, year or 2 years. So I guess there's a silver lining to all of this. If you think about it, it makes some sense. I already went out and I had to buy chainsaws and I had to buy tarps for a house, a vacation home I own up in the central part of Florida that the roof got wrecked and the ceiling fell down and trees are down really bad. That's a much worse situation. Fortunately, it's a vacation home I own, but the central part of Florida, Lake Placid, Sebring, that whole area really got destroyed. As a matter of fact, I took a ride up there because I needed to bring my contractors up there, let them in and get them to work on some of the cleanup before the insurance adjusters came up there. And I got to tell you something, that area is the area where we get a lot of our orange juice from. There are just groves everywhere in that region. And as I drove up that way and I saw the groves, basically what happened is that all the oranges that were on the tree are now on the ground. It was all, they were all shaken off. And if you haven't looked at orange juice futures, they're skyrocketing because they know there's going to be a shortage coming up. And this is going to cause a major problem for that area in terms of orange juice. But on the other hand, a lot of workers are going to be put on in place to repair roofs and plumbing and clear trees and to do all sorts of restoration. So while there is a downtime that's going to be associated with this, the fact is, if you think about it, the money spent from the insurance company's coffers that will be then placed on repairs, renewal, and all of the renovations that have to be done with regard to the hurricane, the houses that will have to be built, the cars that will have to be bought, all the things that go into it, not to mention all of the workers that will be put in place to do all of this, there's a potential for a significant amount of GDP addition that wouldn't have been occurred if there hasn't been a natural disaster. So another bit of a silver lining on that too. Again, the individual suffering and the people that are unfortunately out of power and have to rely on emergency management and FEMA and all that to get their food right now because that area is really in bad shape, and is other areas like Houston and the peripheral areas of Texas and many areas in the West Coast and central of Florida, and not to mention what's gone on in the islands. I mean, that's bad. What's happened in many of the Caribbean islands is just incredible. As a matter of fact, I had a friend who is down there. He manages some marinas in the area, and he told me that the armies are down there, Navy ships and aircraft carriers, Black Hawk, helicopters everywhere, making sure that this whole lawlessness that started because there's nothing going on down there and the people are frantic and panicked and they have nothing that they can get from the stores. There's no shipments coming in. I mean, they're there and helping out, but they said that it looks like just an absolute war zone. Total destruction. of some of these islands. So hopefully you're doing your part to participate, help out if you can in some of the relief efforts through donations to these various causes. And of course, there's been some controversy over like the Red Cross and what they're doing and what they're not doing. So I'm hoping that we can find some that will get a bit more of a direct impact on these areas. In other words, that we can send directly and help them out, not go through the bureaucratic chain of command and poor spending habits and really disorganized levels of aid structure. So if anybody knows some good ones, that would be very helpful. And spread it around. Tell your friends. Let's make sure we get the help down to the people that need it the most. Let's segue into some of the economics that are going on here. Let me tell you what's gone on. Well, I think one of the most important things that we saw last week was that the PPI and the CPI, so the producer price index and the consumer price index, or wholesale inflation and retail inflation, actually spiked up pretty significantly. While we did see that, and more importantly, the CPI, the PPI kind of has been holding on. It was prior, came out on Wednesday, we saw that there was a move from a negative PPI, and a lot of that has to do with the dollar, to a positive PPI, about 0.2%. So that's a bit of an uptick there. On CPI, which was the most interesting, though, we saw an uptick from 0.1%. So if you average that on an annual basis, it's about 1.2% on an annualized basis, to 0.4%, which is like 4.8% on an annualized basis. Now, year over year, it's still a little bit lower than that, but we're definitely getting towards a bit of a significant move on the inflation rate that should have many Fed officials' eyebrows raising a bit and saying, hey, what's going on here? And causing for a very much higher probability of a rate hike in the fourth quarter of this year, possibly even in the next month or so. Now, initial claims did spike as well, and that was probably expected due to the hurricanes, particularly in Texas, that covered this period. We saw that on Thursday, the initial claims moved to about 284,000. That was right in line with the last couple of weeks. We had about 300,000 last week and back to 284. So we're seeing a little bit of move higher there, but again, nothing major, nothing very significant. Still actually very low if you look at the number by itself. Forget about the current trend of what's going on now with regard to the recent situation. And again, much of that is to be blamed on the weather. There's no question about that. Retail sales, though, on the other hand, was kind of interesting. We saw that retail sales were down 0.2% as compared to up 0.3%, and the revised number of 0.3% was down from 0.6%. So in other words, we saw 0.6%. We're all happy about retail sales last month, starting to move along in the right level, but then all of a sudden the revised down, and now we see this month down 0.2%. That's not good. If you extract autos, it was a little bit better. And the revision wasn't as dramatic. But that's showing that there really is just nothing going on the retail sales side. Still very deflationary. Now, industrial production was down also, which is kind of interesting because, we're still not seeing a tremendous amount of movement in terms of what's gone on from the retail to the industrial to manufacturing, even though the ISM numbers are holding up really well, even though Michigan sentiment, the preliminary for September, came in at 95.3. That's down from 96.3 the month prior. But still, we're seeing that there is a good amount of, this has been going on for a while. It probably sounds like a broken record, but we're seeing a good amount of consumer sentiment and investor sentiment. But some of the economics from the retail side are not playing out like we thought they should. Inventories are rising, and that's because sales are down. So it's kind of a strange circumstance when it comes to some of the misses that we saw. And most of the numbers last week were misses. capacity utilization was lower than expected. Retail sales, lower than expected. Michigan sentiment was a little bit lower than expected. So we're seeing a little bit of a drawdown in some of these numbers. Nothing, again, tremendous. We have to continue to see if this is just something that is really due to some of the weather related, but again, nothing to get too upset about at this point. Next week, not a big week in economics. We have on Monday, we have the NAHB Housing Market Index. This is the confidence level of builders. I would think that some of them probably are seeing a little bit more confidence right now with all of the building that's going to be on the horizon, the rebuilding and after the teardowns they're going to see due to all of the flooding in Texas. So that's going to probably be picked up a little bit. On Tuesday, we're going to see housing starts, building permits, import prices, export prices. Nothing really high on the scale. You know, housing starts will be important. Existing home sales come out on Wednesday. That's going to be something to watch. We're expecting about 5.41 on an annualized basis, 5.41 million, that is, versus 5.4. And then on Thursday, we got continuing claims, initial claims, and the Philly Fed. I always watch the Philly Fed. But really nothing else more than that. And Friday is nothing. We also have a little bit of a shortened week in terms of the Rosh Hashanah holiday falls in the middle of next week on Wednesday. So oftentimes there is a bit of a lull during that time. The buy Rosh Hashanah or sell Rosh Hashanah and buy Yom Kippur and all that probably is going to play out a little bit next week. But volumes have been there, creeping back up in markets. That's good. One of the big stories that we did see last week, of course, was about the data breach with Equifax, symbol EFX. And this is a crazy story. I mean, one of the things we're all very concerned about, I think, well, you know what? Let me take that back. I don't think many of us are very concerned, from what I can see, about, you know, doing all of our business online. For a long time, way back, take them 5, 6, 7 years ago, people, I'm not going to be putting my credit card information online. I'm not going to be buying. I'm worried about the security. And then we've evolved into, who cares? Buying everything online. I'm going to buy everything and do all my business online. And obviously with that, we hope that there's going to be high levels of security. And we know there's hacking going on, but many of these companies have good defenses and all that. Well, Equifax comes out with an announcement last week that they were hacked and there was a data breach about 140 million American accounts. 140 million were compromised. And the information they have, by the way, is not just some simple information about who you are. It's pretty much everything about your credit and your bank accounts and your Social Security numbers and your date of birth and everything about you. Now, this data breach, I guess what I saw, it happened in July and they're just coming out with this information now. Well, investors were not happy about this at all. Stock was about 143 bucks before the announcement. Dropped down to about 90-ish. About 4 or 5 days after the announcement. Punished terribly. And then came back up a few points, about 92 and a half, 93. It closed on Friday. Now, I tweeted on Friday that I thought that if it could hold this 92 level, that there was a potential for a little bit of a relief rally bounce for a trade. Nothing to hold right now because there's still a lot going on. There's a congressional inquiry that's going to go on Wednesday. And, of course, we're going to see the usual suspects pointing fingers and, you know, yelling and accusing and just, you know, bad-mouthing and, oh, you big corporations and you this. Now, there was some definite problems with this. I mean, the data breach happened a while ago and they just came out with the information and the announcement about this recently, months later. That's not good. There's been some management changes and there's been already a process to figure out. You can go over to, there's a way to figure out if you've been affected. I went on. I said, okay, let me figure out. Have I been impacted with this? And I went on, I put in my information, and it said, I may have. My wife wasn't, but I may have. I don't know what it means if I may have. Is that definitely yes? Yeah, of course. Yeah, may means yes, you have been impacted. I don't know what that means. I mean, do they have my information? Is it going to be sold on the dark web? Is it going to be, you know, where is it? And what do I do at this point now? So this is something that is very sketchy, but it could be very interesting for a trade if many of the shorts get squeezed here. Where will it go? Maybe back to 100 and change, maybe for a little while. But there's going to be a long effect on companies related in this industry, and there's going to be a lot of potential for regulation on this moving forward. Of course, regulation happens always after the fact. We know that. It can't happen before. You can't get things, you know, designed to have some fail safes beforehand. No, it has to be after the fact that something bad happens. Now, again, this is just an idea for a trade, just something. This is not something I think is going to be, crazy good and just get back to where it was, because there's going to be a lot of lawsuits against them. And again, we're going to have Congress all over. It's going to be in the news for a long time and a lot of people impacted and affected by this. So, you know, just a quick idea. Something else I want to mention to you, as we saw last week, was that, Bitcoin. We saw that Bitcoin, after Jamie Dimon came out and basically called the whole thing a fraud, crashed. It was as high as what, 5,000 and a little over 5,000? It came down under 3,000 for a little while, then rallied. This is not just Bitcoin. This is the entire cryptocurrency and altcoin complex got absolutely obliterated. Kind of a fascinating situation here. We had kind of a 1-2 punch, right? So you had that China said, oh, we're closing down some of these exchanges, ICOs, forget about it, the initial coin offerings, we're not letting it happen anymore. We know that China and Asia are big advocates, or at least the investors, of running into these various currencies and getting their money into there and trying to make all sorts of profits. And once they started talking about a crackdown and regulation on the whole exchange and Bitcoin, that was the start of it. Then Jamie Dimon comes out and talks about it. Then another guy from JP Morgan comes out about it. Then we see a news story just this weekend that JP Morgan actually has a desk that trades Bitcoin for the company and the cryptocurrencies, which is pretty fascinating. So kind of talking about it as a fraud and on one hand and buying blocks of it just right after when it drops down. There was some story about that on Reuters. And then on top of that, we saw another guy, Tom Lee, who's a perma bull in the markets, no question about that, talking about how Bitcoin's going to be like 25,000 in the next few years. So there's a lot going on here in this area. But it is, if nothing else, a very interesting platform and potential for massive gains and massive losses, by the way, for those that are trading it. So again, hopefully we're going to get on my Bitcoin expert. He's been in the weeds with this whole cryptocurrency thing, but hopefully going to get him on soon. Talk about that. We're going to talk about this more also on DH Unplugged this week. We didn't have one last week, but DH Unplugged will be scheduled to run and to be live and streaming on Tuesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern time. So you can listen to it there or get it over on your favorite podcast player and repository, whether it's iTunes or Spreaker or wherever else you get your iHeartRadio, wherever you get your podcast, you can find Google Plus and Google Podcasts and all that. One more thing I want to mention before we get to our guest. This is the official announcement that Investology is open and ready to go. Just go to investology.com with an E. Envestology, Investology. And you can check out this really cool advisor-crafted and technology-enhanced portfolio process where you can go in and actually, you can do it right now. You have to do a quick registration. It's very easy. Do a quick registration and you can start building your portfolio. We took the best of the back end of some of these robo-advisors and how they actually have the technology to help create through a variety of algorithms that the way they do it. And we actually took it and said, you know what? We can actually make this happen in a very high-end way, but also allowing for you, the investor, to actually go in and craft your portfolio based on some very key questions that will help understand what risk factors you are, your time frame, your long-term goals. And then what happens is we create a portfolio. And from there, you just go through some very, very simple steps to create an account over a TD Ameritrade and open the account. And we manage it from there. The online access to look at your portfolio, to access your information, to see what's going on, to look at what investments we have. And we have some of the best investments in terms of both a hybrid approach, and this is the important differential between what you see on traditional robo-advisors and what we're doing. We actually went out and found what we can consider to be the best managers from a mutual fund standpoint on both an institutional retail basis and mix that into the ETF pool. So you have now in areas that you should have, as we see it, active managers running your money as well as passive management blended into a portfolio. Really cool. So you can go over there and click on it and just kind of get the get started, and you can read all about it on investology.com, but also click on get started and just go through there and just register and start crafting your portfolio. You could just check it out. You don't have to actually go through the entire process if you don't want to, but if you just want to see what's going on, you can kind of check it out. But I encourage you, we dropped the minimums down to $10,000. So if anybody has been looking for us to manage like we do our global allocations or similar to that, which we usually have a $500,000 minimum, now we dropped it down for you because you've been asking us to do this. So you can invest $50,000 or $20,000, but down to $10,000 and get some of the greatest managers and the portfolio management that we will handle for you on the back end through this process. Really, really cool. So I really encourage you to check out investology.com. All right, let's get to our guest. Then I'm going to come back with a couple of other ideas in terms of what we could have done and maybe what we want to do in terms of investing in the area of what could be profitable post-hurricane, post-natural disaster, and what we could have looked at and maybe what we should be looking at. But let's get to the guest. And our guest today is Raul Paul, and he's the founder of Real Vision, which we'll talk to him about that. Goes back many years in the area of managing money, understanding about the whole global macro picture. And we welcome today. So, Raul, how you doing?
I'm great, thank you. How's things?
Good, thanks. I know you're based down in the islands. How did you fare during this whole hurricane hoo-ha?
We were lucky. It passed us by, but I've got a property in Miami, which got a little bit dicey, but it's okay. But I'm actually speaking to you from Spain today, where it's beautiful, sunny, and dry.
Lovely, lovely. So let's talk a little bit about, I wanted to start with the whole question about, you know, what are you doing these days? I know you did a lot of writing, you did a lot of wealth management for years. You kind of got out of that and you started this company called Real Vision. And then I want to talk about, I want to set the stage with that. And then I want to talk about some of the recent interviews you had, and we'll go through that. But anyway, tell me about why you started Real Vision.
Good question. Why would I stupidly start a media company of which I knew nothing about it from scratch?
Yeah.
Well, my background was I was in finance. I was working in London. I was working as head of equities and equity derivative sales to hedge funds in Europe. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, my day would be speaking to people like Paul Tudor Jones and Julian Robertson and Lewis Bacon and all of these famous guys back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. So it was a fantastic training for me to learn from the very best of the best. And then eventually, as ever, decided to move to the dark side and went to one of my clients, which was GLG Partners, which at the time was the largest hedge fund group in Europe. It's now part of Man Group, so it's a huge behemoth. And I started up, founded and started the Global Macro Fund for them and then ran that for several years. So my expertise is really global macro.
Right.
So global macro, for those not familiar, really is the top-down approach to looking at the jigsaw puzzle that is the entire world's economies and markets and trying to fit that all together at a top-down level. And that's currencies, bonds, credit, commodities, and everything else in the middle.
You know, it's interesting because I for the longest time, going back to, let's call it the mid-90s, okay? I was always a big proponent of the whole global macro, the top down. Not only, but that was a big component. I always said, you know, if things were going really well from the perspective of economies and markets and government policy and all that kind of stuff, but we didn't have as much government policy back then like it's today, you know, not the overwhelming amount that we have today. But I always thought that, you know, let's take a look at the trends. Let's look at the employment situation. Let's look at inflation. Let's look at manufacturing. And the list goes on, as you know, of all the different things that are out there, right? That I can get a really good sense of what's going on with markets and invest accordingly. And then, you know, all of a sudden, back in, I don't know, pick a year, 2010, we'll call it, when bad news was good news, which threw the, you throw the rule book out at this point, right? And it's changed dramatically, hasn't it?
You know, I'm not sure that it is. I think our psyche's changed dramatically.
So in other words, it's how we react to the information that's different.
Yeah, because there's a collective market psyche about what happened in 2009 and the fact that the imbalances never got cleared. So many of us kind of expect things to happen, these imbalances to clear, but really what's going on underneath is the business cycle is doing its thing. And the business cycle usually lasts for about, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, and then it generally rolls over. So if I look at, I use the business cycle a lot using the ISM survey as my guide. I mean, yes, it's very end of cycle now, but it hasn't done anything truly extraordinary during this cycle to suggest that things have been decoupled. Yes, yeah, equity valuations are way too rich compared to what they should be. You know, fixed income is somewhat problematic, but with an aging population, it makes somewhat of sense. But overall, I think it's relatively consistent with the business cycle. What I'm very interested in is what happens when the business cycle turns negative, as which it always does. I mean, the history of business cycle goes back millennia. Once it turns negative and it should be coming up in the next year or two, then we can see how these imbalances unwind. How do you unwind, you know, the second most overvalued stock market in history? That's probably not a nice situation. You know, so these, the things that we fear, they tend to come in the business cycle. So that's really how I see it.
But now when we look at ISMs, for example, I think we had one of the best global ISM growth rates of decades just recently. In the U.S., it's pretty strong. However, one of the things that's interesting, you said it hasn't reached any kind of, you know, crazy. Everything's been just, you know, it's been fine. I guess the word is right. It's been fine for a while. Everything's going along really well. And obviously, each time there is a change to the business cycle, we don't know what the reason is. It could be a hike of interest rates. It could be something extraneous to the system. It could be a Korean War. We don't know what's going on here, right? But something could trigger something to happen. But when you're looking at this global data points now, and you're seeing that a lot of it is been, I think, enhanced by low interest rates, is that something that is a concern of yours?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, low interest rates is a huge driver of the overvaluation of assets. Now, I don't personally believe that the Fed can do a lot about interest rates. I think they're, you know, they'll try, but can they do anything? I very much doubt it. You know, so I don't think interest rates are necessarily the key trigger, although they play a part in it. Because you can see as they start raising rates in the US, consumption started falling, retail sales started falling, auto sales started falling, and a number of other indicators. So beneath the surface, things are not quite as good as it looks with this very high ISM print. Right. And these are the times that I'm very interested in the business cycle because, you know, if consumption, which is, you know, 2/3 or almost 3/4 of the US economy, is the key component here, well, that's somewhat troubling. So we need to be, you know, paying attention to it because things will change.
So let's go back to Real Vision. So you started this with this crazy notion. You said, I'm gonna be in the media business. First of all, explain to me what Real Vision is.
Yeah, so let's step up back a bit. So I was running a hedge fund. I decided to opt out of the rat race in the end. And I moved to Spain and started writing economic and investment strategy called Global Macro Investor. My client base were, you know, the same, you know, elite hedge funds, sovereign wealth funds, ultra high net worth family offices, pension funds, governments. And I charge a lot of money for that. It's really not a retail product. It's a very expensive institutional product.
Right.
And 2008 happened, and I was one of the lucky people who foresaw what was coming. But after that, in 2009, 2010, 2011, people came to me and said, Raoul, why didn't we know? Why didn't people tell us what was going on? And that's, you know, the average guy. And that really sat uncomfortably with me because those of us at the center of the financial system knew that it was a mess. But those on the periphery, you know, the average saver and the average person had no idea.
Right.
And so I thought, you know, I kind of have a moral duty to do something about this. It's not right because the media let people down because they were too busy treating finance as entertainment and the banks didn't want to tell the truth. So what you were left with this huge hole where people do not get access to good quality financial information. So realizing all of the changes in the media world, which is the fact that you didn't need a broadcasting license to start television, you know, the video on demand platforms were exploding suddenly as YouTube came onto the scene, et cetera. I thought, well, here's a huge macro opportunity for me, which is to disrupt financial media. And so the idea was to democratize financial information, bring the highest quality financial information to a larger group of people than got it before, because they were really underserved. So we started with Real Vision Television, which we went out and interviewed the smartest people in the world. So the world's most famous hedge fund managers, the single best independent strategists, analysts, geopolitical strategists. And as opposed to 3-minute sound bites, we gave them an hour and said, just tell us what you think about the world. You know, where are the investment opportunities? How do you invest? What can we learn from you? Knowing that people had a massive thirst for knowledge, and providing them with the best of the best was something extraordinary. So it's a subscription-based service, and that's been going for 3 years. We're just coming up to our third birthday, and has been a huge success. Yeah. I mean, we have had an incredible range of guests, and we were well ahead of the curve on cryptocurrencies, the fall in the oil price, the move in the dollar, all sorts of things, just because we've managed to curate the best people in the world. And in addition, we then added on various other parts. So we have written research as well, because a lot of the finance newsletters that the average guy gets, they're not very good. And most of the people who write them aren't really experienced. And it's all this stock's going up 1,000%. Well, that's not fair. It's just not fair on the people who are buying these things. So what we did is we formed Real Vision Publications, went out and spoke to 30 of the best newsletter writers, independent analysts, strategists, services that are $40,000 a year down to $300 a year, curated the best of the best, and give examples of that, plus a whole load of other analysis around it. And then we've launched various other products, and including a podcast called Adventures in Finance, which has been an extraordinary journey for us as well. We've had 1 million downloads in our first series, and we've just kicked off our second series. And we have Kyle Bass, is the famous Texan hedge fund manager, is co-hosting it next week. And then the following one is Hugh Hendry, the famous contrarian investor. Mm-hmm. And we also have Jim Rogers co-hosting the podcast. So these aren't even interviewees. They're actually co-hosting, and they're interviewing other people and also being asked questions by anybody on Twitter who wants to ask these really famous people a question. I mean, anybody wants to do that.
What's really great about that is that, so I've been doing a podcast since like 2008, you know, doing a lot of interviews with people all around the world. Some of the best names out there, you know, people that are unknown to a degree, but have some great information, insight. You know, not every interview is the best. You know what I'm saying? You know, but what's really cool about this is I feel that, you know, one of the things that we did was, because we were the first doing financial podcasts, and doing it in a way that wasn't an infomercial. That's the big issue. And I think that what was great about this, it's really brought on a lot of interest, and especially over the last year or so, which is crazy, just the last year. I mean, it was going since 2008. So I feel pretty really good about the fact that we were one of the bit of the genesis of this whole process. So
you guys were pioneers in this.
Yeah,
we did, and this well. You know, it's come a long way.
Yep.
You know, don't forget even things like Planet Money,
yep,
which started, 2009, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Planet Money is the fourth most listened to podcast in America.
Yep.
So
we don't have that ranking, but yeah, they had a lot more money to put out there for marketing.
That's right. But the point being is finance treated properly with engaging storytelling.
Yep.
Is really important to people because they didn't get access to this. So the podcast world is really blazing the trail. And that's what we're trying to do with Adventures in Finance, is not just do interviews, but tell the stories of finance, get on the ground, talk to people, how it affects people, and make it engaging and understanding for people. And, you know, so far it's paid off.
So let me ask you this. You have all these different newsletter writers and publication writers and researchers and all this that go in. Do you have some kind of we'll call it a consensus discussion that you have as well, that looks at, you know, hey, generally speaking, I mean, like a Hulbert does this, you know, his digest and all that. But I mean, what's the general consensus these days?
Yeah, great question. We're just, and this is a hot scoop for you, so nobody else in the world knows this.
Well.
But one of the things that when I started this with the three other co-founders, I said, listen, if these guys are telling us something, we have a duty to tell everybody else. You know, that was the point. That was the point. Ask the smartest people what they thought. And when suddenly the drumbeat is getting louder of one particular viewpoint, then it's our kind of duty to tell people.
Mm.
And what we're hearing is the drumbeat of something is coming, something bad is coming. You know, we're worried about equities. We think volatility is about to explode. We think the economy is not as good as we think. We're worried about China. We're worried about all sorts of issues. And that drumbeat is getting louder and faster and faster and faster. And this is from the greats in finance. And you've seen it, you know, even how Warren Buffett's raised so much cash. You know, it's everywhere. It's epidemic. And it was epidemic before 2000, and it was epidemic before before 2007. And we're hearing the same things again.
Interesting.
And I think that's a really important message.
You know, one of the things that I know that I see when it comes to that same drumbeat is when I start looking at things and I'm like, well, wait a second. You know, when I kind of have to stop myself, when I'm like, let me see this. I see this information about a particular event or a particular trend or something like that doesn't have any effect. As a matter of fact, it has the opposite effect. You know, we saw a few weeks back that there was the missile that was launched by North Korea over Japan. And that whole issue lasted through the overnight session. And by the time the markets in the U.S. were closed, we were green. Now, the bulls will tell you, well, we're in an uptrend. Of course, that's going to be the case. We're going to continue buying and all that. And I get that. I understand that. However, isn't there a time that, you know, now we're like, okay, nothing bothers us. Nothing gets us concerned. Nothing. And when I have no problem with the fact that the underlying fundamentals are good and the companies are good and the macro is good and there's a lot of a benefit to the low interest rates. However, there's still emotions in there, unless there isn't, by the way, unless it's just all machine driven at this point and nobody cares. Just keep on throwing money until all of a sudden the switch is flipped. But something, I agree, something is a little bit different. You know, something is getting a little bit strange in the markets. And you want to, you know, ride it till you get thrown off, but don't get thrown off and get hurt. You know, just to kind of get off on the early stages, if possible.
So here's an interesting thing. We sat down and he's been on a couple of times with Jeff Gundlach.
Yep.
And Jeff Gundlach, the kind of bond king, we sat down with him and talked about stuff. And he said something really interesting. He said, the markets are generally ruled by fear and greed.
Right.
But occasionally there's something more powerful than all of those combined, and that's need.
Mm.
Now, if you understand the baby boomers are desperately saving for their retirement. Every day in the market for them is a little longer that they can retire for,
right,
or a little more comfortably. Undersaved, underinvested, and are not underinvested, they don't have enough investments. So they are terrified of their retirement. Now, the average baby boomer is about 68 years old. They retire en masse at 70 and a half as a trend. So what we're going to see is these guys are taking as much risk because they need to as possible. So they are the buyer of every dip. These guys are desperate to own stocks because if they go up another 10%, that's probably another 2 years worth of retirement income for them. So that power of the need to invest is what's causing this. But in the end, need doesn't hold up a market.
Well, not only that, because need and doing this in a way that's maybe inappropriate, I'm just theorizing here. If it isn't inappropriate, the amount of risk that you take, that you're going to and you're going to say, wait a minute, if the market goes down, I'm going to lose 2 years of my retirement money. You know, I'm only going to be able to retire till, you know, 78, not 79. And I'm not going to have enough money. Then all of a sudden things change around, I suppose. I guess, you know, people can become people right now, there is not much fear out there.
Yeah, I mean, people are driven by greed, right? So what happens is the moment the markets start correcting or the economy weakens, that greed is going to switch to fear. I must protect my retirement.
Right.
I cannot lose my money because if I do, I won't. And also the problem is the longevity of life is increasing. So I don't know how long I'm going to live. So how much money do I need? So the consumption patterns also will collapse post-retirement. So we're going through this huge shift right now. And I think we're in the final stage of that. I need to own equities because it's my only answer phase.
All right, let me segue us for a second here into a discussion of China. I know you recently had Kyle Bass on, which we talked about a moment ago, and he was discussing China, but China has just a massive amount of debt that they've had, and they've done it to try to well, of course, boost their economy, but also, you know, build these ghost cities and all the different infrastructure bills they have and all that. But what's going on with China? What's your opinion of this?
Well, China has been one that's confounded many of us. Kyle Bass and many of the most famous hedge fund managers in the world have been confounded because this is stacking up to be probably the most overextended debt situation of any major economy in all of economic history. So the magnitude of this is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have something like $1 trillion of usable reserves, i.e. things that are liquid, mm-hmm. and they have $40 trillion of debts across the entire economy. So this is a massively leveraged situation. And we're just waiting for what is the shooterfall? Is it the end of the, you know, next session of the government as they get re-voted back in again? The next plenum, is that the case where they can suddenly let things go because they're propping up the banks as fast as they can to stop the banking system collapsing? You know, that they've been given some reprieve because the US dollar has weakened, but if the US dollar goes up again, then they've got a real problem of funding themselves, not being able to export with massive debts, and they don't have an answer of how to get out of it. So it's an accident waiting to happen, but on a gigantic scale.
Now, they're multinationals, and individuals too have been trying to get money out of the country. You know, it reminds me of down here in Florida, there was an influx of money, a dramatic influx of money from South America for a long time, particularly Venezuela and Brazil. And they were buying houses and they were doing everything they could to get the money out. And everybody's like, wow, what's going on there? And then we saw what happened a number of years later. The collapse of Venezuela, Brazil, the currencies just, you know, it was the smartest thing they ever did. We see a lot of people are trying to get their money out of China, the citizens trying to get their money out as are multinationals. Is this a little bit of a tell?
Absolutely, I think it is. You know, if your domestics are desperately trying to get their money out, they don't have faith in the system itself. And the Chinese authorities have tried very hard to stop anything. I mean, it's almost impossible to get money out of a cash point in Hong Kong now because they don't want Chinese taking money out. Mm-hmm. The corporations, they did all this huge waves of M&A and buying real estate in New York and Vancouver and everywhere else. They've tried to stop. The Chinese authorities have clamped down because billions and billions and billions of dollars were draining out on a weekly basis. Also, foreign corporations are stuck. I mean, Kyle did some work on this, speaking to large corporates on the ground in China, big foreign companies, you know, American companies, and they could not get their money back into the US because there was always another piece of paper they hadn't signed or some other reason why it couldn't be done. And they're like, we need to get our money out. But the Chinese were desperately managing their outflows.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they do. They we know they manage the whole process, but I guess I've gotten to a point that I can't even think about the Chinese data anymore and, you know, what's going on there because it's just so wonky. You know, the data has been so odd, but nonetheless, what about Europe, Japan? I mean, what's going to happen with them? And Europe looks like it's coming back. We just saw a few days ago a couple of comments that, you know, they're in a great part of the economic cycle right now. Things looking good. Every manager that I hear is talking about Europe, Europe, Europe. And they were right about European shares doing much better, particularly when you look at them in relationship to the U.S. We saw that the euro has gone a lot higher. Some of the best performing ETFs and mutual funds are European this year, but they got a 10% boost because of the differential between the dollar and the euro. However, a higher euro is not necessarily good for those companies, right? Inside Europe.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely key to understand. Is the higher euro is bad because Europe's an exporting nation bloc as a whole. I also think it's pretty late cycle for Europe too. So everyone's piling on to the latter part of a trade. You know, when everybody's doing one thing, it's usually time to start looking at the other. It may be a bit early, but I would be a little bit wary of Europe.
Yeah. And it looks like there's some concern about, I mean, obviously this whole, you know, North Korea hoo-ha, China Sea, you know, the issue with much of what's going on now. Myanmar's got all sorts of refugee problems. We're seeing there's a lot of votes coming up. But yet in the U.S., we have the potential for a tax reduction, or they talk about tax reform. It's more of a tax reduction. You know, other than that, on a global basis, are there any other hotspots we need to be looking at?
Yes, I think one of the biggest hotspots. Well, there's two really key things. Firstly, nothing matters except the US dollar. Once you understand where the US dollar is going, you know where all assets are going, basically. So the US dollar has been weakening. I don't think the US dollar bull market is over, but maybe I'm wrong. But either way, everyone needs to understand if the US dollar weakens, emerging markets outperform, commodity currencies outperform, and commodity countries outperform. If the dollar strengthens, it's the reverse. So that is a key trend. So if the dollar does weaken from here, then the ability to own emerging markets, which are starting to potentially break out from a 15 to 20 year consolidation pattern, is coming. If that's the case, you can almost own emerging markets, go to the beach, come back in 10 years. Yeah, you'll get some big nasty sell-offs when the US has a downturn or the global economic cycle has a downturn. But overall, emerging markets will outperform. I'm not ready to accept that that's the case yet. I still think the dollar goes higher. So I'm not prepared to commit to that. But that's one thing. Within that emerging market theme, India, I think, is probably the best major market story in the world. Their demonetization story is one of the most extraordinary things I've ever heard. Mm-hmm. They've basically created an entire digital economy for 1.3 billion people without the rest of the world even noticing.
Yep.
It was an unbelievable thing. Firstly, they gave everybody a social security number, but that's linked to your fingerprint and your retina scan. So it's biometric. And then they got everybody onto that system and then said, okay, with this system, you can now also attach your documents in something called India Stack. So that system's called Aadhaar, the number. Then India Stack is you can put your documents, your utility bills, your proof of ownership of your residence, your birth certificate, and all of these things. So now with that, you can go and sign up for a mobile phone account using your fingerprint, and it's cleared in 20 seconds because all of your client stuff is held. They also have a payment system that's 50 times faster than Bitcoin currently is, without a bank in the middle. So we can just transfer money to each other instantly. So that's got rid of all of that friction. They've put all of the subsidies and pension system and everything attached to the same. So what they've done, and then they banned large currency notes. So what they've done is force people into the financial system, recapitalizing the banks. They have removed a lot of the frictions within the banking system, and then they've allowed people to go out and borrow money, get insurance, and all the things that they couldn't do without all of this official information on file. So it should free up the India economy, and it's still in its infancy. But my guess is over the next 10 years, India will be probably the best performing major economy in the world.
By the way, the whole thought of fingerprint scanning to get for payments, or even retinal scanning, or some kind of fully digital. What it also means is, it scares the hell out of me a little bit. What it also means is, I like to have cash every once in a while to pay for things. I don't know what, but I just maybe I'm an old timer, I guess. I mean, I use the Venmos, I use the PayPals, I use the cash, I use all those things too, and the various cryptos and whatever it may be. I'm on board. But at the same time, you know, the thought of and there's obviously still some cash in the markets. But, you know, sometimes you pay somebody to do a little work in your yard or something like that. The last thing I'm going to do is ask him, hey, you got a Venmo account? They don't. You know what I mean? They don't have a PayPal account. It's easier. They don't even have checking accounts for that matter, many of them. So
yeah, and you're dead right. So India hasn't banned cash entirely. It's banned big notes. And basically that's to stop a lot of corruption. You know, you can still pay people in cash, buy things in cash. And so it's still a cash society. Don't forget, India was a 97% cash-based society. So what it meant is nobody in the entire economy was paying taxes. The banks were underfunded because people didn't put the money in the bank. And the black economy was enormous. So much got skimmed off that economic growth is held back.
That's a good point you make there, by the way. It's really, really, really tough to bribe somebody and pay them without cash. Hey,
yeah.
Can I pay you in? Can I pay you with, it's like, hey, I'm going to pay you. Can I pay you for that bribe in credit card? No, I'm sorry. Can't take credit cards for bribes. You know, I mean, it's a whole different thing. But anyway, all right, listen, we're going to end it there because we have a lot more that I want people to see over on Real Vision. We'll put all the links on the show notes for this episode, episode number 526 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. By the way, 526 episodes, my friend. We've only
You are well ahead of us.
But anyway, hey, thanks for joining us, and we'll make sure we'll have everything on the site so they can check out where to get more information for it from you.
Yeah, because I think people are going to love our podcast. It's different to yours. It adds to the whole thing. You know, we love working with other podcasts as well because we're all trying to kind of do our own thing and changing the world. And also, if they go to realvision.com, they can have a look at some of these amazing interviews. There's a free trial that's open. You don't even need a credit card, so they go and check it out.
Perfect. Thanks so much.
Brilliant. Thanks very much for your time.
All right, bye-bye. Yeah, that was cool. Yeah, I heard you. Check out Real Vision. Again, we'll have all the information over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Before we got to the discussion, and I think that some of the, you know, I got to blame as to, while we're recording this, we're still having a little intermittent problems with the internet. So we'll blame the weather. I'm going to blame the weather. Something I'm always very critical of, but I'm going to blame the weather on some of our internet connection there. So if Roald kind of popped out here and there, I apologize for that. Before we went and had our discussion with Raul, I mentioned that there were some investments we could have looked at and maybe thought that would be beneficial during this time. I mean, you know, you don't want to profit on anybody's misfortune and misery, of course. However, if you think about it, what would have been, you know, I don't know, you probably thought about this. What could have I invested in before this hurricane happened and would have done well? About a year ago, I mentioned that there's seasonally a real good move on a company called Generac, GNRC. Take a look at that chart. You'll notice that did pretty well. This is a company that basically makes generators. They sell them in Home Depot. They sell them all around. There's some whole house generators and portable generators. That's a company that would have done very well if you would have invested in it just before these hurricanes. And during hurricane season, that company usually has, the stock price usually has a seasonality that's pretty good. Now, what about moving forward? What about some of these car companies? What about a company called Carvana, GM, Ford? I mean, there's 300,000 to 500,000 cars that were ruined in the floods that happened in Texas. There'll be a lot of them are going to have to be replaced. Now, there's some stories that have been circulating that they're going to try to see about maybe really pushing up the whole idea of ride sharing in that area, and maybe there won't be the sales that you see. But you know what? Many of these people had insurance. And they're going to go out and buy a new car. We're still not at a place that people are going to be en masse just saying, you know, forget the car. And I'm just going to go ride sharing. I mean, there may be a pocket of people that do that. But what about some of the car companies? That could be something interesting to take a look at. So, you know, there's also, you know, and some of the other thing I was going to mention was some of the companies like Airbnb, where people had to go find houses and use, you know, alternative places, hotels that got, you know, some got hurt, but some of them are going to, you know, be filled up for a while, especially the extended stay. So think about the opportunities that are out there as well. Take a look at some of them on the charts and, you know, make some good choices there. But I would start taking a look at some of these car companies as a beneficiary of some of this. And of course, we did see that the opposite is true as well, where many of the insurance companies have gotten slammed lately because there's going to be the requirement for them to pay out enormous amount of money on the damage that happened during these storms. And who knows what's coming moving forward. So take a look at that. Carvana, GM, Ford, and the rest of the car companies, as well as maybe some of the online, maybe not the travel, but you can look at possibly the companies that do the short-term, Airbnb is private, of course. But you may want to look at some of the companies like Expedia, which has divisions, even though they have heavy travel, but they have divisions that have short-term rentals as well. So just a thought. Anyway, we're going to wrap it up here. I want you to make sure to listen to DH Unplugged this week coming up. We'll talk about a lot of the things that are on your minds, as well as some follow-up on what's going on with the hurricane. What happened with some of my Amazon goods that didn't arrive, which we'll talk a little bit about what happened there, as well as all the news that we've missed over the last couple of weeks because we didn't have a show last week because we didn't have power. And also, don't forget to go to investology.com. Make sure you do that. I'll see you next week. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.